The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway this morning on the Salem News Channel as well, if you're watching at home on TV. Good morning. I begin with news from Israel, where an Israeli man became the eighth civilian killed by Hezbollah via rocket attack from Lebanon. 10 soldiers have been killed, total of 18 dead in the north. Yesterday, Israel struck a target deep inside of Lebanon, and of course, 30 rockets were launched in response, wildly, as they always do. I saw Guy Benson last night at Fox News when I was over to do Brett Baer's show, Special Report, and he had just come back from Israel and explaining to me what the North is like, and it's truly weird and empty and spooky. And when they went down to the kibbutz and to the scene of the Nova Festival, it's horrific, but more Americans have to go, and Guy and Mary Catherine went, a number of other people went, and more will be going. Dozens of gunmen have been killed at the Shifa hospital raid yesterday and today, and it's grinding on because apparently if you join Hamas, you check your common sense at the door and you don't realize that once the IDF has been through a building, they're probably going to leave behind the sensors that indicate you're back. And they did, and they set a trap, and they sprang it. The IDF also confirmed the killing of three Palestinians in Jenin last night, and Shin Bet announced it had foiled a plot by Iran to smuggle advanced weapons to the West Bank for their terrorists there. Meanwhile, the New York Times looks at all this news. Israel on the brink of a war in the north and a continuing war on the south. Dozens of gunmen in Shifa Hospital. And they write the story headlined, "Domestic political pressures widen divide between Biden and Netanyahu." That is absolutely true. Netanyahu has 90% of Israel, wants to kill off Hamas, finish the war. Some of it wants to occupy Gaza, a very small percentage, but all of it wants to destroy Hamas and the tunnel system. I don't even know who the 10% are. Maybe they're not actually living in the country. I can't imagine not wanting to finish the war off. But the domestic problems for Joe Biden is leading to extraordinary things. A word now on the abstention. We didn't get a chance to talk about this on Special Report last night. But when the United Nations held a vote on the resolution that called for an immediate ceasefire and did not link it to the hostages they broke with Israel. And we did worse than break with Israel. We abstained. The world's leading country, the superpower, number one, uno, on top of the world, we could not decide whether to vote yes or no. Now, only Barack Obama has failed to veto an anti-Israel resolution. He did that after he was a lame duck. Joe Biden screwed Israel and the American Jewish community, and the Friends of Israel, who are Zionists and are not Jewish in the United States, when he instructed the United States Ambassador, Linda Greenwood Thomas, or is it Thomas Greenwood? I always get it mixed up. The instruction was to abstain. It is a cowardly act. It is a despicable act. And Israel sent Ron Dermer out to give the message yesterday, which he did on Fox and Friends. They canceled his trip. Prime Minister said, "Dermer and friends, you're not going to the White House. We no longer really care what Biden says. We do care what the IDF is up to, and I'm glad the IDF sent the defense minister to meet with the Pentagon people about weaponry tactics, etc. But we no longer really are going to do politics with you, and I'm glad." And Ron Dermer went on yesterday with Bill Hemmer and said this, cut number three.
I understand that's the position of the vice president and the U.S. administration when it comes to a major military operation in Rafah. But when it comes to consequences, Bill, let me tell you the consequences of us not going into Rafah and not getting rid of these four remaining battalions of Hamas. Essentially, we have dismantled the terrorist army of Hamas. We've got five battalions left. Four of them are in Rafah. They have somewhere maybe 7,000-8,000 terrorists there. We cannot afford to not go into Rafah and finish the job, because then what they'll do is October 7th again and again and again. So there's no chance that Israel is not going to go and finish the job in Rafah. Now, I was supposed to be in the United States today in Washington to discuss the proposals that the U.S. administration has. They were going to suggest us ways where we don't have to do it with a major military operation. Now, I don't see that it's possible to do it. Of course, we were open to listening to them. But the mistake was that yesterday when they decided not to veto that resolution, they sent a terrible message to Hamas that you can get a ceasefire without giving up the hostages, without making a hostage deal. And I think the combination of that message that was sent to the UN Security Council and Israel going to discuss how we're not going to do a major military operation in Rafah would have sent the exact wrong message to Hamas. That's why the prime minister made the right decision to not send a delegation. And I hope we can put the U.S.-Israel relationship back on track, because for over five months, the U.S. has backed Israel, and we're going to win this war.
And I think it's important to win it with the United States. I got it. President Biden.
But they're going into Rafah. Understand that. Now, how is the war going? Haviv Redig-Gur joined Dan Senor on the Call Me Bat podcast and gave a brief update. Cut number 14.
I have positive views about how the war is going on the ground. Pretty much everything I could hope for is happening on the ground. My concerns are with the political framework and with our government and the American government and various allies and even our opponents in the region. I think that the army on the ground is doing an astonishingly good job in all the ways that matter. Palestinian civilian deaths are way down. Still, sometimes, you know, awful videos or awful pictures come out of Gaza. But the fact is that the numbers are way down. The fact that Hamas's numbers aren't just contradicting reality now about the death toll, but they're contradicting Hamas's own numbers from 2 months ago. The 6,000 dead Hamas fighters Hamas acknowledged a couple months back have now been shrunk down to 4,000 dead fighters as the civilian numbers that Hamas releases go up. So it's just there's a lot of fake out there from their side.
And that's just based on you matching new numbers relative to old numbers. So these numbers wind up contradicting each other.
Yeah, there's some numbers that came out of some Hamas official. I don't think it was even tagged the health ministry, but it did spread around a bit that the Palestinian civilian deaths are now continuing to climb precipitously. But now Hamas, or the people at least spreading the numbers from Hamas, are claiming that some 90% or something like that are civilian deaths. But Hamas itself admitted that there are 6,000 Hamas fighters dead, and that's way more than 10% of the new numbers. And so the whole numbers game out of Gaza is just utterly fake and false. And that's true irrespective of whether Israel's right or wrong. It's true irrespective of what you think of the war. It's true irrespective of, frankly, the numbers could be higher. I don't think they are, but they could be. We would have no way of knowing because Hamas isn't counting. It's inventing numbers out of whole cloth. So what we know from the ground from the Israeli side, and we don't know it just from official Israeli reports, which there aren't really a lot of, actually, what we know from soldiers, what we know from commanders, what we know from the way the war is being conducted, and what we know from simple questions of the fact is aid agencies aren't dealing with, you know, massive numbers of casualties ongoing, that the civilian death toll is way, way down. The rate is way, way down. And the Israeli soldiers' death rate is way, way down. And that has been interpreted in some places as the Israeli army standing in place, which to me is a little bit of a weird thing to say, because you and I, based on Israeli officials, knew 5 months ago that this war was going to have several stages, and that after the above ground territory of Gaza is taken by the army and Hamas's sort of official infrastructure of battalions and various headquarters and arms caches and things like that are destroyed, then Hamas will pivot to an insurgency, to small cells attacking and disrupting, and the Israeli army will take a long time to degrade them. Everyone can go back to the podcast, almost every podcast that you and I have recorded in 5 months, and know that that's the next stage. And I think we talked about 9 months to 2 years of that stage.
It's a very good set of news. Right? So Israel is winning the war. It is doing so very carefully. It is methodically moving through Gaza. It will go into Rafah. And in my opinion, it's going to end up in Lebanon at the end of this. What we cannot have are the morons who are running the Biden administration foreign policy continue to abstain at the UN. They need to close the daylight with Israel. They need to make it very, very public statement that they are behind Israel. And they have not done so for political reasons, domestic political reasons in Michigan and Minnesota. Those are the two state solutions. They're afraid of losing Michigan and Minnesota, but what they ought to be afraid of losing is every supporter of Israel. They've already lost every supporter of Israel because Joe Biden put the knife in. When I come back, we've got John Haidt coming up today. We've got to talk about Ronna McDaniel. I got a lot more to do. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. As you know, NBC hired Ronna McDaniel last week, former chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, and they fired her unceremoniously yesterday. There's lots of news about this. I'm going to play you the celebration that they held at MSNBC last night. Understand, if you watch NBC or MSNBC, you're paying Rachel Maddow. Rachel runs the network, and I think we've just got to be upfront about that. She and her band of, and they're all derivative of Rachel. She got a good brand with the 1%. She's a 1%er, smart, lefty, hard left. Really, I say smart in terms of she'd do well on the SAT. She does not know how the world works, but she is the voice of the resistance, and they hate Donald Trump there, and whether up and down the network. But the funniest line I read this morning doing show prep is at Semaphore. You may never have heard of Semaphore. It's one of these newsletters by, for, and of Washington, D.C., and New York. All right, so it's the Boswas axis. So it's the highly deep blue Boston, Washington, D.C. corridor and the people who work along it in New York City. And Max Tanney is their media correspondent, among others. And he wrote with others, quote, NBC will have to manage its brand with Republicans as it attempts to repair what insiders see as a management failure as much as a political blunder. Running a talent-heavy television newsroom is a legendary exercise in internal politics, and executives typically keep stars close, consult them often, try not to surprise them. It's a star system, and there is no bench, said one former top NBC executive. The move also deepened tensions between NBC News and MSNBC leadership, which has been strained at moments through the last several years. I can only tell you how bizarre this is because I was there, right? I was in the room with Ronna and Caesar and Rebecca and Carrie and Lester and Kristen and everybody else from NBC when we got ready for the debate in November. And I am myself a veteran of NBC for 4 years. I was asked by Brett Baer what I thought about it last night. Let's play what I said first. Cut number 10.
All right, Hugh, you used to be over there. How about this thing?
Well, Ronna is a friend, and I did work for NBC, and in November I worked with Caesar and Rebecca and the whole team. I've never seen anything this brutal since I got started in media in 1990. Ronna is going to sue everyone who defamed her for breach of contract, for intentional infliction of mental distress. They are going to sue for the destruction of her business opportunities that come from being on TV. I think they made a terrible decision, and they allowed the MSNBC bleed to take over their network. And the cult has taken over the news division, and it's going to hurt the 74 million people who voted for Donald Trump are not going to watch NBC News. That's all I really need. I don't believe anyone believes they can get a fair shake. They've got a few token Republicans who are never Trumpers running around MSNBC, like Michael Steele, and there are a few others, and they're nice people. Look, I really don't dislike anyone. It's not my nature to dislike anyone. I do want, you know, it's just, the left has taken over NBC News and MSNBC. They started there. They landed there. Normandy was MSNBC. Rachel Maddow went ashore there, and they spread out, and they took over the network. They drove out everyone who was normal, everyone who's centrist, everyone who's center-right. Then they try and get a debate. And so they beg them, we'll work with anybody. And We get asked, Salem Media gets asked, would you partner with CNN? Would you partner with NBC? We'll say we'll partner with anyone. We presented with CNN, but we will work with anyone. So they called us up, and CNN went through their turmoil, and they asked us, what'd you do? And I worked very closely with these people for a month. We had 12 rehearsals, hours and hours, but no one from MSNBC. There's a division, right? NBC News is NBC News. We're a good news organization. We wouldn't dare be political and crazy like the people at MSNBC. Well, that broke down. Let's listen last night. Rachel Maddow, cut number 16, celebrating with Joy Reid.
Our chairman of the NBC Universal News Group, Cesar Conde, who we both know very well, he sent a memo that we all got as employees here, rescinding the hiring of Ronna Romney McDaniel. And I know I felt very strongly about it. I know you felt very strongly about it. I think everyone from 4 o'clock on, from Nicole all the way to midnight, we all felt very strongly and said so on our respective shows yesterday. And I just have to say, when somebody does the right thing, I feel like it should be acknowledged as publicly as we acknowledged our outrage. And so I know how I feel about it. I am grateful to Cesar for actually making the right decision. I think it was the right decision, but I want to get your take as well.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me about it. I still feel like a little, it always feels wrong to talk about things, you know, in the company.
Agreed.
As if it's news. And I, you know, it's just this, it's not the way either you or I are wired.
All.
I know, but I will just say that journalists are a fractious bunch. And in our big company with all sorts of different journalistic entities, you have all sorts of different people working in this business, doing all sorts of different kinds of work. And to see the essentially unanimous feeling among all the journalists in this building
That's
and all
it.
The sort of senior staff and all the producers and everybody in this building about this was one thing. But then to see the executives and the leadership hear that and respond to it and be willing to change course based on it, based on their respect for us and hearing what we argued, I have deep respect for that. I do. I mean what I said on the air last night.
You see what they're doing here is, oh, well, all the journalists said the same. They're not journalists. They're activists. They are as active on the way left as I am on the center right. They are propagandists. They are not that smart. They are absolutely, in the case of some of them, dumb as a brick. But, they are left wing. And so they scared the suits into submission. They took control of the building. They have control of the building. Your news is polluted. Let's go down to Chris Hayes, cut number 18.
NBC News announced that Ronna Romney McDaniel, the former chairperson of the Republican National Committee, will not be a contributor to the network. This comes just 4 days after NBC News announced her hiring as a political analyst. As you might know, we don't have a show on weekends or on Mondays. Between then and now, I've been closely following the news and talking to lots of people inside the company. And most of what I wanted to say about all this has already been said very well by my colleagues, from people like Chuck Todd and Joe Scarborough to Nicole Wallace and Joy Reid and Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell and others. There's a reason so many people have this reaction. It's not because McDaniel's a Republican or a conservative and everyone thought, oh, no, a Republican on NBC News. We all recognize a variety of views is vitally important in understanding our country, in doing good programming. The reason this precipitated the visceral gut reaction that it did is that there's just a pretty bright red line in American life after January 6th. On one side of that line are people who aided and abetted in this attempt to end the democratic system as we know it, to steal a free and fair election, an attempt that, as Rachel noted last night, is ongoing. It's very much still happening. There's lots of Republicans who tried to stop that. But Ronna Romney McDaniel is unfortunately on the wrong side of that red line.
It's another slander. Just mark it down, Ronna, and to your team of lawyers. Just another slander. Here's Alex Wagner on MSNBC, cut number 20.
Before we go, I do have an update on a story that some of you may have been following in recent days. NBC News has announced tonight that it has dropped former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel as a paid on-air contributor. Now, that decision comes less than a week after this company announced Ms. McDaniel's hiring, and it is due in no small part to the efforts here, both in front of the camera and behind it, to make clear that her hiring was a very serious mistake. A lot of my colleagues in primetime here, actually all of them, have weighed in on this, so I'm not going to belabor the point, except to say election denialists do not belong in the payroll of a news organization.
Another slander. Alex Wagner gets added to the complaint. Rachel went back on her own show later in the night, cut number 19.
It's my understanding that MSNBC's leadership did not object to Ronna McDaniel being hired by NBC News when the matter first arose. But when the hiring was announced, an MSNBC staff essentially unanimously and instantly expressed outrage. Our leadership at MSNBC heard us, understood, and adjusted course. We were told this weekend in clear terms, Ronna McDaniel will not be on our air. Ronna McDaniel will not be on MSNBC. And I say that and give you that level of detail because there has been an effort since by other parts of the company to muddy that up in the press and make it seem like that's not what happened at MSNBC. I can assure you that is what happened at MSNBC. Ronna McDaniel will not appear on MSNBC. So says our boss since Saturday, and it has never been anything other than clear. And I will also say, you know, if you care what I think about this, I will tell you the fact that Ms. McDaniel is on the payroll at NBC News, to me, that is inexplicable. I mean, you wouldn't hire a wise guy. You wouldn't hire a made man like a mobster to work at a DA's office, right? you wouldn't hire a pickpocket to work as a TSA screener. And so I find the decision to put her on the payroll inexplicable. And I hope they will reverse their decision. And
it's, I guess that's before it was announced. But she slandered her a couple of times there, calling her a mobster and a pickpocket. So the number of slanders and the election denialism, all I have to say, I want to know what you think. 1-800-520-1234. I was surprised genuinely that they fired Ronna because she represents 74 million voters of Donald Trump who did not participate with the 800 people in going into the Capitol. Election denialism does not have a definition that anyone knows. It's whomever they want to smear. Show me the man and I'll find you the crime. They're Beria people. If you don't know who Beria is, and probably no one at MSNBC does know what Beria is, and I doubt that anybody at NBC knows what Beria is. They're simply character assassinations. When you leave the RNC after 6 years, you know everybody and everything, and you know every funder in town. And I think they purposely destroyed Ronna, or tried to destroy Ronna, and they think they may have, in order to make sure that their network never gets close to having a real Republican on there who will defend Donald Trump and who will say, of course you should vote for Donald Trump, as I've already told you, of course you should vote for Donald Trump. In November. We can't take four more years of this foreign policy. We can't have an Afghanistan collapse. We can't invite Putin into Ukraine. We cannot backstab Israel. We cannot spend the money that Joe Biden did that did not stop the Francis Scott Key Bridge from falling down despite all the money on infrastructure. We cannot just stand by, and we cannot patronize NBC. And I will miss Steve Kornacki. I like Steve Kornacki. I think he's the best in the business. Nobody else will I miss. All right. And I don't think, as Ari Fleischer said last night, they should never again be in a debate. They should never again get a town hall. The self-interest of some candidates may take over. They might fire everybody at MSNBC and start over. But I doubt it. They got their 1%. They're profitable. 1% is profitable. But that's what they should be stuck with. Except over to Alliance Defending Freedom banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. Alliance Defending Freedom has got a Supreme Court argument next week. They win, typically, at the Supreme Court. They've won 15 times in the last two decades, 15 times. It takes about $1 million to win one of those cases. I just urge you, whether it's $5, $50, $500, Alliance Defending Freedom, it's completely tax deductible. They preserve your rights in a court, at least part of which is hostile to your First Amendment rights to free speech and the free exercise of your faith. So please support Alliance Defending Freedom. The banner is at HughHewitt.com. At the top, you cannot miss it. Stay tuned. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is, but we don't. I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No,
you haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy. It's wise. It's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined by Jonathan Haidt, the author of this brand new book, The Anxious Generation. And if you have been listening to me or following me online for the last many weeks, you know I've been talking about this a lot. Jonathan, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. It's great to hear you, have you, but I've got a little problem with my earpiece here. How are you this morning?
Doing very well, Hugh. How are you?
I am great. You have a bestseller on your hands. Are you surprised that this many people are anxious about the anxious generation?
No, not at all, because whenever I've talked with parents, pretty much everybody who has a teenager or even an elementary school student is thinking about this. Most are worrying about it. Most are struggling with it. It's a constant fight in many families. So I kind of had a guess that the audience for the book was going to be all parents forever, which, yeah, that's a pretty good formula for a bestseller.
All parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts. I'm a grandfather almost six times over.
And teachers, yep.
And they're all under 12, so I got it in time. But I love the fact that throughout you make your thesis statement clear, page 139. And I want to make sure I read it exactly right because it's the thesis statement of the book. And I put it online because I said, oh, it's nice he repeated the thesis statement of the book at the beginning and the end. It's like a speech. Tell them what you're going to say, say it, and tell them what you said. I'm saying, you write, that the great rewiring of childhood, in which the phone-based childhood replaced the play-based childhood, is the major cause of the international epidemic of adolescent mental illness. This is not an opinion, John, right? This is the science.
Well, there are always debates within the science. This is my reading of the scientific literature, which I've been debating with other researchers since about 2019. I think that my side, which includes Gene Twenge, the author of iGen, I think the trends, the new research has supported us. So, you know, in terms of the scientific literature, I believe the preponderance of the evidence supports that claim, exactly that claim. What I do in the book is I review not just the research on depression and anxiety. That's where the academic debate has been. I say, even if we put aside depression and anxiety, these things are clearly fragmenting our kids' attention. They can't pay attention. There's a lot of research on that. They are addicting between 2 and 10% are basically have a behavioral addiction. They're depriving our kids of sleep. They're pushing out books. They're pushing out hobbies. So even if I was wrong about the depression and anxiety claims, there's so much else that is happening to our kids because their lives moved away from play, normal human childhood, and into this weird virtual world created for adults by corporations whose goal is to grab their eyeballs and never let go. And these corporations have a congressional grant of freedom from liability. They can't be sued for what they do to our kids. It's completely insane.
So I'll stop there for a moment. I do believe we are on the cusp of liability. I don't know that liability has been established yet for any of the producers of this, but the book of yours collects enough evidence for me that I'd be very worried if I was one of the owners of some of these social media companies about the consequences. Has it succeeded as a cause of action anywhere yet?
Well, so as far as I know, no, but here's the key thing to keep in mind. The Congress granted the tech companies immunity from being sued, from being liable for what other users post. And that makes sense. AOL back in the 90s, you know, you couldn't have people suing AOL because, you know, Joe Smith put up something nasty about Tom Moore. I mean, the original purpose of the law was reasonable, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. But the courts and common practice seem to have interpreted that so widely as to say the companies can't be sued for anything that they do to your kids, even when the plaintiffs can show that they put in features specifically designed to pull in minors, underage users, to hook them, to addict them, the design choices that they made for their platforms, those have somehow fallen under the umbrella of Section 230. So as far as I know, none of the suits have succeeded yet, but there's a huge wave of, not exactly a class action lawsuit, but of grouped lawsuits moving through the courts. So we're going to find out in the next year or two.
And I think what we're going to find out is that the social media companies like the cigarette companies have got a nasty situation on their hand that will result in billions of liability. But let's go back to 2007 and the first iPhone. Did they have any idea when they began, John, in your honest opinion, what they were unleashing on the world? Or were they just having fun?
No. Well, let's distinguish between the hardware, which is the iPhone, and the software, which is Meta primarily, because they were the first and the biggest, both with Facebook and then with Instagram. So in terms of the phone, no, I don't think so. The iPhone in 2007 was an amazing, amazing invention. I got one in 2008. You should think of it as a digital Swiss Army knife. You know, like you pull it out when you needed something. Like if I needed a map, I'd pull out my phone. If I needed a flashlight, I'd pull out my phone. The phone was not commanding me to do things. It wasn't interrupting my day. There were no notifications. There was no app store. So, you know, the Apple iPhone was an incredible world-changing product that most of us, most adults love. The issue is when the iPhone got the App Store and notifications. So now millions of companies can install software on the phone in your kid's pocket. And by default, they have the right to interrupt your kid, whatever he's doing, and try to get his attention. Say, hey, do you want to see what someone just said about you? Click here. Now you can turn off the notifications, but most kids don't. So it really is not the iPhone in 2007, 2008 that caused the problem. It's really the period from 2010 to 2015, which I've called the great rewiring of childhood, where at the beginning, most kids have a flip phone. They don't have an iPhone in 2010. But by 2015, they have an iPhone. They have a high-speed data plan, high-speed internet. They have an unlimited data plan. They have Instagram. And now you've got kids. Many kids are spending 10 hours a day or more on their phones. In fact, the average today is between 7 and 10 hours a day just on their phones.
And what's interesting, John, like teenagers everywhere and preteens for all time, they know how to avoid the detection of what they are doing that their parents have forbidden them to do, right? They know how to get out of the house at night. They know how to get alcohol. They know how to drive. They do everything. But you point out, I mean, there are many things I want to talk to you about. Gen Z, quote, are not doing as much bad stuff as teenagers used to do. They drink less alcohol, have fewer car accidents, get fewer speeding tickets, have far fewer physical fights or unplanned pregnancies. Well, I guess that's good until you realize they're not going out, Jonathan Haidt. They're staying home, sucked into this weird world of online games and online chatter.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So even your characterization before, that they know how to sneak out at night, they know how to get alcohol underage, that's not true anymore because they're not doing that. Basically, you come home from school, you sit on your bed, you're on your device. That's what a lot of kids are doing. We found amazing data for the book about injuries. Broken arms, broken bones. Teenage boys used to have the most. Obviously, you know, teenage boys, they're doing reckless things. They're
lived it, been there, done that, been to the ER. Yep.
Yep, that's right. That's right. But that no longer happens very much because teenage boys now are slightly less likely to get injured than 50-year-old men. Teenage boys today are slightly less likely to have a broken bone, a broken arm, than teenage girls were 15 years ago because they're not doing anything that could possibly injure them. They're not having adventures. They're not taking risks. They're not learning how to measure risks. They're not doing things that would help them turn into men.
Yeah, you know, John, when I read that, I know about the damage to the executive function. I know about the anxiety. I know about the sleep deprivation, the attention fragmentation. I did not realize the adversity to risk. And I talked to my daughter yesterday, and she got a 19-month-old who just almost broke himself in two yesterday. I said, that's good. We want bruises. We don't want scars. And that's a quote from your book, which I'm not just going to tell.
It is. How did she respond to that?
She said, good, 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 because we're going to get plenty of them with this guy. This guy's just a tyro. But okay, would you explain that to people? Because I think it's one of those lines, we want bruises, not scars, and we want a lot of bruises.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't quite say we want a lot of bruises. I gave a talk. So summer camps are some of the most amazing things that you can send your kid to today because they're one of the few places where your kids can detox from their phone. And summer camps have a lot of physical activities. And I gave a talk to the Camp Directors Association a few months ago. And I thought that I would, you know, I thought they're probably going to be overprotective and I need to, you know, get them to loosen up and let the kids take more risks. And I said, what is the optimum number of times per summer that a kid comes to the infirmary with an injury more serious than a scrape? Is it zero? Would you like to run your camps that nobody ever gets hurt? You know, is it 1 to 3 or is it like 50 to 100? And I don't know what the correct answer is, but I was really glad to see nobody picked zero. They all recognize, no, if not a single person is getting hurt, then kids aren't taking risks. You're not letting them swing on a rope into the lake. You're not letting them run. So that's what I meant by that. that we don't, there's a great Canadian play researcher. She says, we need to keep kids as safe as necessary, not as safe as possible. And since the 1990s, we've been keeping our kids as safe as possible, which means we're blocking their development. They don't have adventures. They don't take risks. They don't learn how to become self-supervising. And then we send them off to college where professors like me have to deal with students who don't know how to manage their own affairs or how to face exclusion or someone ignoring them.
I often talk on this show, Jonathan, about my four-year-old granddaughter, who I call Genghis Kate, because she is a looting, ravaging, coming from the steppe of Asia kind of person. And when I go to the playground with her, I lose her. And I've learned not to lose that. It is the exact replication of your advice. The cure for parental anxiety or grandparent anxiety is exposure to it, meaning go a few times, let them out of your sight, and then you won't lose any sleep over it. It's wonderfully practical advice in this book.
Yes, because a big part of the problem is the parental anxiety. So there are two halves to the story in the book. I can summarize it by saying the problem is that we have overprotected our children in the real world while underprotecting them online. And we have to reverse both mistakes. Now, overprotecting our kids in the real world, yeah, it includes not letting them walk three blocks to a playground. It includes not letting them climb up to the top of the jungle gym. Oh, wait, there aren't any jungle gyms anymore. Well, there are sort of climbing structures.
I love the picture of the old gym.
I had the same experience. yes, that's right. There's a picture in the book, you know, of kids climbing up like 25 feet in the air. I mean, things used to be too dangerous. I'm very glad that there was a consumer safety revolution. We needed that. That's a good thing. But yeah, it's, you know, the first time my wife and I let our son walk to school. We live in New York City. It's, you know, it's very safe in terms of crime, but there's a lot of confusing traffic and bicycles go in the wrong direction. And the first time we let him walk to school in fourth grade, we were really anxious and we tracked him. You know, I'd given him my iPhone. Nowadays I would give him a watch or a flip phone, but we'd given him my iPhone. We could track him. And the first day we were so anxious watching him cross 7th Avenue, which is a complicated intersection, but he did it. He did it. He was able to do that. You know, like, of course, look, you and me, we were all crossing streets when we were 7. So
we're going to come back to this. Don't go anywhere, Jonathan. Hey, I'm going to talk to John during the break. We'll put that onto the podcast as well, and then we'll be back on the broadcast after that. Don't go anywhere, America. The name of the book is The Anxious Generation. The Anxious Generation is in every airport and every bookstore at Amazon.com. The Anxious Generation, subtitle, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, and Jonathan Haidt is not overstating the case. Stay tuned. I'm joined by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. I've been mispronouncing it, but I got it right there. Jonathan, you break out the boys and the girls, and the girls have a different set of problems than the boys. Let's deal with the boys first, because I was surprised by the withdrawal. They are addicted, and we know about porn, and we know about video games, but they are withdrawing from pack behavior, from friend groups. I hadn't thought about that.
That's right.
How big of a problem is this going to manifest in their ability to work for the next 50 to 75 years?
Yeah. We don't know yet, but all the signs are that it's going to really interfere with their ability to get jobs, to be a force of nature, to invent things, to start businesses. So let's start at the beginning here. The story for girls is very clear. We'll get to that. Girls, their mental health goes off a cliff in 2012, and it's clearly linked to social media. That's what I thought the book was going to be about. I thought it was going to focus on girls and social media when I started. But as I did more research with my research partner, Zach Rausch, and we really tracked down the boys' story, what became clear is that boys' mental health begins to deteriorate several years before the girls. And it's not linked to social media very tightly. Social media hurts a lot of boys. You know, they get sextorted, they get bullied, but it's not the major thing pushing them off the developmental path. Rather, boys have been kind of dropping out of the real world and moving their attention to the virtual world and computers since the 1980s. As video games got better and better, boys spent more and more time playing them. Video games are great fun, but you don't learn any skills that would be useful in the larger world. For example, when boys are out playing a pickup soccer game, they have to pick teams, which is sometimes awkward, but you have to go through it. They have to set rules, and then there are all kinds of ambiguous cases. And then they have to be a judge and a jury. And how do we work this out? And how do we keep the game going? None of that happens in video games. In video games, there can be no conflicts because the platform takes care of all the rules and all the enforcement. So my point is, as boys spend more and more time on video games instead of things in the real world, they're beginning to lose competence. As boys spend more and more time on pornography, you know, boys have always had, it's a, you know, it's hard, you know, you find some picture somewhere, or a magazine, you know, a catalog, anything. But now that it's hardcore porn showing graphic anal sex to any 10-year-old who just goes to Pornhub, now that they're immersed in really graphic hardcore pornography, that can satisfy their sexual urges as they're going through puberty. They're less motivated to actually do the difficult task, which is talk to a girl. So in all these ways, boys have been basically withdrawing from the real world where there's real work, there are real people, and they're having fun online. Now, you might say, well, as long as they're having fun.
This also explains why college applications for boys are way down. One of the things you did not say that I'm saying, I have a couple of friends who are college presidents, trying to keep the 60-40 ratio is very difficult. And I think boys are just afraid to go. We'll be right back on the air with Jonathan Haidt. Don't go anywhere, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. John Haidt is my guest. His book is The Anxious Generation. It's everywhere, and it needs to be everywhere. I want to recommend to the people in the country who have book clubs that you get this, because it's actually very practical. In fact, John, the last 25 pages are very specific, and I want to get to the age of the phone. And I, for a long time, said if you let kids drive a car first, they'll be able to negotiate the virtual world later. And so I'm so glad that you agree with what I've been preaching to my kids. No phones until 16. Would you explain why that is? No iPhones until 16.
Yes. That's right. So the proposal I offer in the book is no social media until 16, no smartphone before high school. And the reason is that once a smartphone enters a child's life, it's going to take it over. There is really no way to stop that. There's so much interesting stuff happening. A smartphone is an experience blocker. It's give them a lot of experience through the phone. They'll get dating through the phone. They'll get sex through the phone. They'll get entertainment through the phone. They'll get news through the phone. But they're not going to spend as much time talking with other people. Now, in an ideal world, I think we'd wait till 18 for that. But I understand that's not practical. Some parents may want to do that. I'm not saying don't give them a phone. You can give them a flip phone. A lot of parents tell me the Apple Watch works great because they can communicate, they can text, but the kid can't reach the internet. The key idea here is that puberty is a very, very special time in which a child's brain is rewiring. It's literally changing its neural configuration, beginning in the back of the brain, moving to the front, to change a child's brain into an adult brain. And the most important part of this rewiring, easily disrupted by experience, is the prefrontal cortex, the area just behind the front of the forehead. That's the seat of executive control, a kid's ability to focus, to set goals. It's really important that kids develop executive function. And the social media platforms, we know from leaks about Facebook, they know all about this, and they know what kids' vulnerabilities are, and they exploited them. We know that from Frances Haugen's revelations. So what I'm arguing is, let's at least protect early puberty. Let's at least get all of this out of middle school and elementary school. Kids need to play. They need to do face-to-face interaction. They need to develop basic skills. And there's even evidence that the greatest period of harm is 11 to 13 for girls, but 14, 15 for boys who enter puberty a bit later. So I'm saying let's protect puberty as much as we can for as long as we can. And I'm suggesting a norm, because if parents are just told, wait as long as you can, well, when is that? When is the pressure overwhelming? What I'm trying to do is say, hey, how about we all just adopt a norm? We don't do this before high
school.
John,
do you think it's possible? Because I always make lists when I read a book, and the Anxious Generation have a very long list. But the most surprising fact, all right, this is it. Older teen girls get one notification per minute. I had no idea. I knew the 11 notifications an hour is for all children, but one per minute for an older teen girl. This will destroy the ability to do lower level math, much less calculus. It's incredibly destructive. So you know what we did with smoking is first we removed advertising in ballparks and then from TV. Can we at least ban notifications?
Well, you can't ban notifications, although there are a number of bills that try to put a bunch of things together to make the online environment less toxic. So, for example, there's a good bill in Congress. It's the only one that really has a chance of passing. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's the one that a lot of us are putting our hopes in, for at least for this year, called COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act. And it does things like it mandates that the platforms set everything to the maximum privacy setting by default. If a kid wants to broadcast herself dancing for older men, she can choose to, you know, she can choose to take it off and make it public. But at least by default, creeps and weirdos can't see your daughter doing whatever she's doing. So there are a bunch of things like that that would make things better. But my view is we don't want kids spending 6 or 8 hours a day at the age of 11 on their phones, on their platforms, and then try to make it safe for them. We want to just get them off. They should not be doing that.
Yeah, it's why you don't let 12-year-olds drive a car, John. I really do think the anxious generation may change this, but I may have to ask you to stay one more quick segment. The biggest pushback I get is from parents. We can't do that. We need to know. And you and I have talked about this before when your Atlantic article came back. Is that changing?
What's the reason?
Is that changing?
Well, first you tell me, what they give you? When parents say they can't do it, why? Why do they say they can't do it?
What if I need to get them? What if they're stranded somewhere? And then you get the school shooting comes out after three questions. But one example
that's
I got
right,
was their car broke down. Well, you know what happens? You end up walking to a gas station. That's what happens.
No, hold on a sec. Wait, Hugh. What you're pointing to here is the fundamental misunderstanding, which is I'm not saying no phone of any kind. I'm saying no smartphone.
Yep.
So the millennials went through puberty with a flip phone in their pocket. If their car broke down, they could call AAA. They could call their mom. That's fine. I'm not saying we have to go back to when you and I were young, when we had to be resourceful. I'm just saying, how about if their car breaks down, they don't get to spend an hour on TikTok? Like, what's the loss there if they can't access social media if their car breaks down, if all they can do is call people and text people? So the point here is not to isolate our kids so they can't communicate. It's to free their attention so that they don't spend all of their available time doing things on the phone. They have some time to do things with real people.
The Anxious Generations in bookstores everywhere. I'm going to ask John to come back for one more question for me, which I've got on my list of must-asks. So do not do anything except go get The Anxious Generation right away. I'll be right back with John on the podcast, Highly Concentrated Hugh, and I'll play it tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you for listening. Welcome back. I'm back with John Haidt talking about his brand new book, The Anxious Generation. And this is on the podcast. I'm going to play it tomorrow morning in the first segment. John, the question that I did not get answered, and I don't think you set out to answer it, is what do we do if the child or the teenager or the young adult is already addicted, is already withdrawn, is already, I'm never going to give you a phone or I'll hurt myself, I'll cut myself or anything like that. What does a parent do?
So, of course, it's easiest to delay when they're young. But look, you know, most of us, all of us who have teens, the teens are already on phones and mostly on social media. What do you do? Well, don't despair, because there's a lot that you can do. Now, what they're afraid of is being isolated, being separated. And so everything gets easier if you can talk to the parents of their friends. If you have a small group that is doing this together, then it becomes much easier because they're terrified of being the only one left out. But if there are other kids, then it's much easier. But even if you don't have cooperation from them, from other parents, what I'm finding in my class at NYU, I'm a professor at New York University Stern School of Business. I teach a course called Flourishing, about 35 undergraduates, mostly sophomores, 19 years old. Most of them are addicted to their phones. They check their notifications the very first thing when they open their eyes in the morning. It's the very last thing when they close their eyes at night. And they get 300, 400 notifications a day.
God.
And what I do with them is I say, you know, I say, okay, look, do you want to achieve something in your life? And these are business students. They say, yes, we want to do something. Do you think you can do anything if you have zero attention to devote to your projects? No. Do you want to regain control of your attention? Yes, they all do. So I say, okay, let's take out your phone, because we have a totally screen-free class otherwise. But take out your phone, go to notifications, check your notifications. Let's track them. And now scroll down and you'll see where you can turn off notifications. You have given permission to hundreds of companies to interrupt your work whenever they want to. That's crazy. So I say, turn off all notifications except for five. You get to keep five. For example, Uber or Lyft, like you're surely going to want to keep notifications on so you can meet up with the driver. That's great. But, you know, breaking news from Variety magazine, like that somebody is getting a divorce, like, no, you don't need to be interrupted during your homework to know that. So once they shut off their notifications, it's like you're pulling cobwebs out from in front of their eyes. Like, they actually tell me things like, wow, I was able to do my homework last night in an hour. I just sat down and I did it. Because normally, everything is multitasking. Everything is continuous partial attention with very low quality work. So my point is, a lot of this is not, it's not set in stone when they're 12, 13. It's habits that develop, and the brain is still malleable until the mid-20s. So if young people change their habits, they can change their attention. If they change their attention, they change their lives.
John, I have one also question. Do you think the military helps young men who are lost? And by lost, I mean they're just not capable of doing anything.
Yes. So that's always been the case, that troubled young men, men who were not really toughening up, often found that boot camp and military camaraderie really turned their lives around. There's a wonderful book out, a memoir by Rob Henderson. He was in foster care for most of his life, a horrible, terribly sad story. But he got himself into the Air Force, and that really gave him the structure and discipline he'd never had. He then got a scholarship to Yale, and he's now a public intellectual. So, yes, I'm a big fan of the military for young people, especially for boys. You know, my own son is interested in ROTC. He sees the attractiveness of being part of a team working for a larger cause.
Well, congratulations on the Anxious Generation. I think that it's going to have ripple effects. I certainly hope that school boards are obliged by parents to read it, meaning don't go yell at your school board. Go take them a copy. I mean, just go buy five copies for your school board and just give them each a copy and say, I'm going to come back in a month. I'm going to ask you what you think about page 139, which I read your thesis statement from. Do you think that's actually going to happen? Is there a kind of rebellion of parents and grandparents ongoing?
Yes, it is happening. And the reason why I am so optimistic about this, first, is that it began in Britain last month. So in Britain, their problems are the same as ours, actually a little worse. Their kids are on even longer than ours are. And in Britain, parents have had enough. And as soon as someone put up a flag saying, hey, parents, join this WhatsApp group, thousands and thousands of people responded within 24 hours. Everyone's had enough. Now, in Britain, they have a functioning legislature. They have a parliament. And their parliament has made some laws like phone-free schools. Like their parliament has mandated that schools must lock up phones during the day. This is insane to let kids have the greatest distraction device ever invented sitting in their pocket while they're supposed to be paying attention to the teacher or each other. So the rebellion began in Britain last month, and I'm very confident that we are at a tipping point right now in America. We're here. Parents are fed up all over the country. They've had enough. They're tired of hearing, like, oh, it's your responsibility, parents. We cannot, as parents, we cannot keep our kids out of bars and strip clubs if the bars and strip clubs won't check IDs. We can't keep them from doing things they're not supposed to do if the companies won't participate at all. We need help from Congress to help push the companies to act. But here's the point. I wrote the book assuming that we will never get help from our legislators. I wrote the book assuming that our Congress is so broken that they can't do anything. Now, I hope I'm wrong. They might prove me wrong because this is a bipartisan issue. But even if we never get help from Congress, if parents just reach out. Yeah, but you're probably on a text thread with your kids' friends' parents anyway. Reach out, talk to them about the book. Say you saw something about the Anxious Generation. You know, this guy suggests that we all not give our kids a phone until high school. I'm planning on doing that. What do you think? Would you do it too? And believe me, they share your fears. The parents of your kids' friends share your fears. So I think we are at a tipping point. And the fastest way to push it is phone-free schools. So all parents, if you're listening to this, if your school allows your child to keep a phone in his or her pocket during the school day, this is damaging your child's education and mental health. So contact the school and say, please, you know, please, can we go phone-free? And if you can do it with a bunch of other parents, that's even more powerful.
And let's start with a PTA meeting where we talk about it. Let's not get crazy. Let's not get angry. Let's just talk about it and then sing Hail Britannia. Britannia rules the waves because they've done it nationally. So if Great Britain has done it nationally, ought to at least talk about it in our PTA, John. And I think you may have changed the world this way. My hat is off to you. Very few books actually change behavior. I think the Anxious Generation may. Thank you for spending so much time with me. Good luck on launch week.
Well, thanks so much, Hugh. Thanks for letting me get the word out and push on this tipping point.
We will. John Haidt will be back with me before long, after his first round of interviews. We'll have him back for a longer one. Thank you, John.
Oh, my pleasure.
retired General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.